Okay, good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is GI Jews, the experience of Jewish soldiers, sailors in World War II, in the American military forces, based largely on the book written by Deborah Dash Moore, GI Jews, which was also made into a documentary, and many of you might have seen it. It was on PBS multiple times. So the first question is, why was this book written? And the answer is that the Jewish experience in the military, in the American military in World War II, had largely taken a back seat to other Jewish storylines of the war era. Most importantly, the Shoah, the Holocaust, is the dominant theme of Jewish storytelling of the war years. But also, for that matter, Zionism, the situation in Eretz Israel from the time of the White Paper through 1945 is another major storyline, and we've covered that in classes on Zionism in past years. But the experience of Jewish soldiers in the American military was overlooked as though that wasn't all that important. And Deborah Dash Moore felt that the story needed to be told. Her father, Martin Dash, is one of 15 boys, so to speak, who she interviewed and whose life story she tells in the course of the book. It's told through the experiences of specific people, not as a generic tale, but the individualized stories of her father's friends and a few others. But more importantly than just the fact that it had been overlooked, there is the arc of American Jewish history that Deborah Dash Moore's career had been following. Her first major work, and I think it was her doctoral dissertation, was At Home in America, a book that we discussed a number of weeks ago before Pesach, The Jewish Interwar Experience in New York. And At Home in America meant that the Jews of interwar New York of the second generation, meaning the children of immigrants, felt as though they were at home in New York. They thought they were at home in America, but what they didn't realize was that their version of America didn't go west of the Hudson River, or maybe even west of the Harlem River. And it was a very parochial version of New York. And they would not understand the full meaning of America until they experienced the war and wandered around the country from army base to army base, getting a fuller picture of the land in which they held citizenship. Her second book after At Home in America was To the Golden Cities, which talks about Jews moving to Miami and to Los Angeles after the war. Having seen the bigger America during the war years, they didn't want to just live their whole lives in Brooklyn and the Bronx. They saw there was elsewhere in the United States and there's where to go. So she comes back to that in her third book, GI Jews, in which she explains, how did American Jewish boys come to see this bigger United States that was less ethnic and less parochial than their childhood, adolescent, and teenage years in ethnic Jewish New York? Okay. Now, the book starts off with a description of what was on the minds of young Jewish boys in the late 1930s. So we're talking about teenagers, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, in 1939, August, and into early September 1939. When the war is starting, or just before the war starts, your average Jewish teenager was thinking about sports, the World Series, the Dodgers versus the Yankees, about college. They're going to go to City College, NYU, Columbia. Can I get into Harvard? Will I go to Yale? Who their girlfriend would be, going to the movies, going to the theater. These were the mundane things, important things, but mundane things that were on the minds of the Jewish youngsters as war was breaking out in Europe. Some Jews, some American Jews, were ideologically driven. That is to say, they were focusing on events abroad much more so than your typical American Gentile, and for that matter, even typical American Jew. So if you were ideologically driven, then if you were a leftist, and a far leftist at that, then starting in 1936, you might have joined the Abraham Lincoln Brigades and fought in the Spanish Civil War on the side of the Loyalists as an anti-fascist. So Jews did this in disproportionate numbers to their percentage of the overall population in the United States. Or if you were a Zionist, you were paying attention to the goings-on in the Middle East, to British policy vis-a-vis Palestine, to the fate of European Jews in terms of trying to get out of continental Europe and go to Eretz Israel. If you were a pacifist and had taken the Oxford Oath, which was to never fight in any war, which was a reaction to World War I and the horrors of World War I, then you paid attention to the events abroad, but with the intention of never fighting, of hoping for a more peaceful world, but refusing to do anything about it. Over time, attitudes evolved. And one of the things that changed attitudes was the Molotov-Von Ribbentrop Pact of August 23rd, 1939. If you were a Jewish leftist in Brooklyn throughout the 1930s, then you viewed the Soviet Union possibly with a favorable eye. Yes, there were those who viewed it with a jaundiced eye because they knew about the Stalinist purges, but there were plenty who viewed the Soviet Union favorably. But once the Soviet Union enters into a pact with the devil, with Nazi Germany on August 23rd, 39, does your attitude change? And the answer is, for some American Jewish leftists, yes, you become fervently anti-Nazi and now suspicious of the Soviet Union and willing to fight despite the Soviet Union's pledge of non-aggression. Or you're a real far-gone super-duper commie and you make your peace with the non-aggression pact on the grounds that, you know, Stalin must know what he's doing. And he hasn't truly made a deal with the devil. So these are some of the ideological things that are going on in the world and how they might affect the mind of the young Jew. But for the most part, the Jewish boys are like the American boys and the American Gentile boys, and they're not focused on world affairs. Between 39 and 41, this will change. As it's clear that the Jews of Europe are suffering, it's also clear that the Jewish constituency in the United States is one of those that are pushing America towards war. And an anti-Semitic response would be that we shouldn't let those darn Jews push America into a European conflict that isn't our own. Fortunately for American Jewry, it was not a German military action against the United States that precipitated American entry into the war, but rather it was a Japanese action against Pearl Harbor, which meant that America was willingly going to war with the Japs, with the Asians, with those who don't look like us, the funny looking Asians. And racial bigotry played an important role in the willingness of Americans to go to war. If it was only against white Europeans, then the willingness might not have been as so strong. And even after the war started, there was this sentiment that, you know, the Jewish war was in the Atlantic theater, whereas the Goyish war was in the Pacific theater. And, you know, the racial differences between white America and yellow Japan played a role in wanting to continue this war to the end, to a bitter end, as opposed to, you know, why are we fighting Germany? Is it because of the Jews? Who people didn't even understand. Okay. Now, what would the war do in the long run? So tonight I'm going to focus on a few different things that happens, a real change that happens over the course of the war. So one thing is, Judaism would be given legitimacy in the United States as one of the three fighting religions of democracy, the three fighting faiths of democracy, together with Protestantism and Catholicism. That Judaism, which represents only 2% of the population, is elevated to a very high pedestal together with the other, you know, two major branches of Christianity. This is a wonderful thing from a Jewish perspective because it allows the military to cater to Jewish interests and to give Jewish soldiers the sense that they are welcome and a part of this enterprise just like everybody else. Another thing it does is raise Jewish self-esteem, because being able to fight and fight sometimes, you know, in elite units at the front lines and be decorated with medals for bravery, it shows that the Jew is no longer the wimp to be pushed around, but rather the Jew is capable of defending himself and defending his country. It will also transform Jewish self-understanding, that Jews go into the war with a certain attitude about themselves, sometimes an inferiority complex about their physicality, or a sense of, you know, what are the, you know, the dominant traits of their personality, and exit the war recognizing that I'm not the same person I was when I went in, and I'm better for it. And lastly, we're going to see how the war encouraged intra-Jewish ecumenicism among the various denominations of American Judaism, Reform, Orthodox, and Conservative, something which is foreign to our experience today of interdenominational cooperation. There would be significant cooperation during the war, and I want to explain at some length how that happened and what were the favorable results of it. Okay, so the big question that Jews had in December of 1941, and to be honest, this question existed even before December of 41, but it was acute after Pearl Harbor, was whether to be enlisted, whether to enlist or to be drafted. So for those who were not eager to fight, and this is certainly the case before Pearl Harbor, then you would wait to be drafted. And there was a draft before, in 40 and 41, which did take in a considerable number of people. But if you didn't want to fight, you'd prefer not to be drafted. On the other hand, if you believe that America needed to go to war to fight fascism and to fight the enemies of the Jewish people, maybe you want to enlist and hope that America enters the fray after Pearl Harbor. So there is another factor. If you assume you're going to be drafted very soon because it's happening to everybody, all young men, unmarried, of able body, were likely to get called and inducted. So if you were going to get drafted anyway, there was an advantage to preempting that draft notice and enlisting, insofar as you got to choose which branch of the service you wanted to go into. And people did have preferences. Some wanted to be in the Navy. Some wanted to be in the Army Air Corps. There was no Air Force yet, but there was the Army Air Corps. People had ideas of where they would prefer to serve that best suited their talents, or, you know, not even talents, but their image of, you know, what military service would be like. And so, yes, people were drafted, but plenty enlisted throughout December of 41, throughout all of 42, and sometimes people who were underage, who was 17, wanted to be to enlist, sometimes to the chagrin of their mothers, and they would need a parental permission slip to be enlisted at the age of 17. And mothers would struggle over, agonize over whether to let their young boy go before his time. There was also the question of a 4D exemption for divinity students. And at Yeshiva College, this was a big deal. Why at Yeshiva College more so than JTS or HUC? For a very simple reason. Because JTS, and especially HUC, the students there were all students studying for the Congregational Rabbinate. And at best, they would serve as chaplains once they graduated, and there were plenty of chaplains. And we'll talk about the military chaplaincy soon enough. But Yeshiva College and its associated Rabbi Isaac Elkanon Theological Seminary, REITS, not everybody there was going to be a rabbi. People were there just going to college, or they were at MTA, or then it was known as TA, Talmudic Academy. They were in high school, and then they would go to college. And yes, there was REITS on the side, which was made you a yeshiva bacher and could give you a deferment. But if you weren't planning on being a rabbi, were you going to hide behind REITS as an excuse to get out of the war? What if you wanted to fight? So among the students of Yeshiva College, there were many who could who had the opportunity to avoid the draft, but chose that this was a war that they wanted to fight in. And in Deborah Dashmore's book, G.I. Jews, the example from the YU orbit is Victor Geller, who went on to have a nice career in the Communal Services Division of YU. Okay, and he, at an early age, decided he wanted to fight and would go on to wear his tefillin every day throughout the course of the war, even while serving in combat. Once the war, Eli's asking, could you choose where, Europe or Pacific? And the answer to that is, generally speaking, not. That generally was not up to the individual soldier, unless there was a particular unit that you wanted to join that you knew was going to one theater or another. But on the whole, you didn't have much of a choice. So there was an embarrassment factor if at a certain point in the course of the war, you were seen back home in the ethnic Jewish neighborhoods of New York in civilian clothes. If you were, you know, a 20-year-old, a 22-year-old, a 23-year-old in civilian clothes walking the streets of Flatbush or Borough Park or Crown Heights, or for that matter, the Grand Concourse, and people didn't think you were unhealthy and you weren't a divinity student, what were you doing out of uniform? To not be in the war was a shanda, was an embarrassment. And so that's another factor, that even if you didn't want to fight, there was the shame of not participating. Americans did not fight for ideological reasons. Jews tended to do so, recognizing that the fate of world Jewry was in the balance. And this also plays a role in the decision to enlist and the willingness to take on a fighting role as opposed to just a backbencher's role in the war, that plenty of people never saw combat, including of the 550,000 Jews to enter the service, 350,000 of them never saw combat, never got close to combat. But because there was a reason to fight that was specific to our people, it's a desire to get to the front. Of course, not everybody has that desire, and some people are afraid of mortal danger and try to, you know, hide behind as far in the rear as they can. But there were those who wanted to fight because of this motivation. Jews were thought to be bookish and not athletic and not good soldier material. This had been true ever since the days of Moses Mendelssohn. If you recall from past years, we spoke about Moses Mendelssohn and his machlokes with Johann Michaelis in the intellectual world of Europe in the 1770s and 1780s, and the question of Jewish emancipation. And there were those who defended, among the Christians, who defended Jewish emancipation, and there were those who were opposed to it. And one of the reasons for opposing it was Jews are weak physically and emotionally and will not make good soldiers. And Mendelssohn fought back and said, we'll fight as well as anybody else. And if you accuse us of being too short, we'll show you. So was this a canard and an anti-Semitic stereotype, or was there an element of truth to it? Well, we have to acknowledge that even the Jews themselves thought there was more than an element of truth to it. Jews recognized that growing up in Brooklyn and the Bronx, okay, that they were more likely to be studious with their nose in the book and less athletically gifted than their heathen fellow citizens who grew up on the farm in Oklahoma. All right, and for this reason, basic training would have to transform them physically. So for the kid who was scrawny and underweight, so they ate a lot of basic training and they built themselves up, they bulked up. For those who were a little chubby, so they slimmed down. What about Jewish boxers? So boxing was an important way, was a very important way of getting into physical shape. Boxing was accepted among Jews, you know, ethnic New York Jews, as a suitable form of athletic activity that would get you into good shape. Okay. Some mothers cried. Asha is asking, beside the legendary Mo Green, Mo Berg, not Mo Green. Mo Green isn't the godfather. Mo Berg, were there others, including espionage? Yeah, there were Jews involved in espionage. Absolutely, definitely true. Jews had linguistic capabilities and were involved in spycraft. So mothers cried and grandmothers cried and wailed when the draft notice came in. And sometimes they remembered the Cantonist system and the Tsarist army in Russia. Of course, we're talking about 1941-42, and the Cantonist system hadn't been around in 90 years, and Jews hadn't been inducted into the Tsarist army in at least 30 years. But the cultural memory was still there, that Oy Vez Mir, to go into the Goyish army, we'll never see our boy again, or at least we'll never see him as a Jew again. That was a real fear that some of the mothers and grandmothers had. Was it justified? In this instance, absolutely not. World War II did not destroy the Jewishness of the American Jewish soldier. If anything, it strengthened the Jewishness of the American Jewish soldier. There was an accusation that Jews didn't serve. And one of the anti-Semitic slogans early on in the war was that the battle hymn of the Jews was Onward Christian Soldier. that the battle hymn of the Jew was Onward Christian Soldier, that the Jew doesn't serve. Now, the other claim was that Jews would get away with cushy jobs, that they were in the zone of the interior, which was stateside, or that all Jews were in the quartermaster. Now, I have to acknowledge my grandfather was a sergeant in the quartermaster and served admirably from 1941 through 1946, and did go overseas to Europe, to the Pacific, and fought in Burma, and occasionally had to use his weapon to shoot at the trees when he saw Japanese soldiers. So now the anti-Semitic draft boards would sometimes reject Jews from the more prestigious units. That was an ongoing problem. My other grandfather on my father's side had a problem with a corrupt draft board and probably anti-Semitic draft board also in Brooklyn. And he ended up, instead of being home with his mother because he was the last son home, he ended up in the Battle of the Bulge. So there were issues in terms of accusations about Jews not serving, but then also anti-Semitic issues of preventing Jews from serving or serving in the way they would have wanted to. Now we turn to the cultural shock that the Jew faces when entering the army. And one of the big issues is food, food. You know, Jews love food, but what are you going to eat in the army? And so this past Shabbos, I spoke for Parsha Shmini in Shul, for those of Manche Shalom who were there, about Jews and pork. And I quoted a little ditty that was around in 1942. And it goes like this. Ikey, Mikey, Jakey, Sam, we're the boys that eat no ham. We're all in the army now, so we're eating ham for Uncle Sam. So eating ham for Uncle Sam was a nice little slogan that said that we're going to compromise our religious scruples and our cultural affinity in order to do the right thing by America. And that is to serve our country and to serve it with, you know, good physical constitution by making sure we have a hearty meal. There's a question in the chat. Are there any data about the number of outright Jewish draft dodgers? I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question. I'd have to look into that. My guess is there probably isn't any such research. And the reason why I think so is because, unlike Germany in 1916, which conducted a Judensalon, a Jewish census, after the accusation that there was Jewish draft dodging, America of the 1940s was not Germany of 1916, in the sense that the American government didn't really think that there was a problem. Yeah, sure, the anti-Semites and even anti-Semites in the military might have made accusations against Jews collectively, but those in charge of running the government in the Roosevelt administration probably didn't believe it at all, and it probably wasn't very true. So my guess is there isn't much data on that, but I will look that up. So when Jews went off to war, you know, they're going from their homes to Fort wherever, whether it's in New Jersey or down south or somewhere in Pennsylvania or Ohio. They're going somewhere off to some fort for basic training. What do they take with them? Well, the mother, the grandmother, the neighbor gives the guy a mezuzah, a chai, a Jewish star, some good luck charm, and a Jewishly oriented good luck charm. And the boy, you know, even if he's not religious and is not especially inclined to obsess over his Jewish identity, nonetheless would tend to take these items as they were given, as mementos from home and the wishes for hatzlacha, best of luck. Say goodbye to parents before the induction. And one of the things that happens is you meet a fellow Jew on the train on the way to the fort. And you befriend that person. You never met them before in your life, but now you have a friend to go through basic training with, who's your landsman, who's your ethnic kinsman. And sometimes the mothers would arrange this to happen before the boys would depart. How did Jews deal with eating treif? So the answer is, depends who you were. Some Jews ate the treif with gusto, gobble it up, no hesitation whatsoever. Others did so with revulsion. And by the way, even non-Orthodox Jews sometimes had trouble with the pork chop. That even if you didn't have a religious objection, you just never ate pork because you were a Jew and Jews had a certain diet. And this was foreign to you. even if you didn't think God was going to strike you down with lightning for eating it, you just had trouble chewing it and swallowing it down because this was foreign. Some tried to avoid non-kosher meat. They tried to survive on sardines and salmon. And you'll hear stories of people from the prior generation, or from the war years, who said, oh, yeah, yeah, I would steal a can of sardines, I would steal a can of salmon from the mess hall because I didn't want to eat the pork. And others would receive guidance of eat what you need to for pikuach nefesh, to survive. It's a mitzvah to survive, so you'll eat what you need, but don't enjoy it. So, as Uncle Benny's father told him, don't suck the marrow out of the bone of the pork chop. Because if you suck the marrow, it shows you're enjoying it, good to the last drop. If you just eat what you need, pikuach nefesh. Okay. Getting into fights with anti-Semitic Gentiles was a standard thing during basic training. Why specifically during basic training? Because the goy from an out-of-the-way place in Middle America has never encountered a Jew before. And this would not be so once you went overseas and were in combat. And yes, still anti-Semitism would be a problem even there. But it had been reduced in its severity because after a year's worth of training, people hopefully simmered down in their bigotry. But the bigotry was strong when you first encounter someone you've never met or seen before and you don't like their ethnic religious background. So Jews needed to learn how to fight. Fist fights happened. Gentiles from small town America tended to believe, incorrectly at that, that Jews from New York, from the big cities, big East Coast cities, would be sophisticated. After all, they come from cities where there are skyscrapers, big buildings, and big industry. You know, for a kid from small town America, from Nebraska, from South Dakota, they never saw a building taller than three stories. So here a Jew comes from the big, big city. He must know a lot. But as it turned out, the Jew disappointed the Gentile in that regard. Because really, the Jew from Brooklyn or the Bronx was not so sophisticated. In fact, whereas the goy could probably drive a car and had been driving since he was 16, the Jew from the outer boroughs of New York, he took the subway at most, didn't have a driver's license, didn't know how to handle a car. The goy from Middle America was probably sexually active from the age of 15, whereas the Jew, the 18, 19-year-old Jew from New York, probably was a virgin. And so the locker room banter was foreign to the Jewish kid. Also, the Jewish kid was not from the big city. He did not go to Manhattan. Manhattan is the big city with the big tall buildings and cultural sophistication. Where did the Jew come from? The Jew came from a small little neighborhood that was bounded by 161st Street and 167th Street between Jerome Avenue and the Grand Concourse. You know, a 6x4 square block area, that was the Jew's neighborhood. He didn't know from the big city. Yeah, his father worked in the big city and took the subway every day, but I didn't go. I'm just a kid, living in the Bronx. So there was no sophistication, and that disappointed the small town Gentile. One of the things that Jews encounter for the first time when they go down south is Jim Crow and real racial bigotry, whites against blacks. My grandmother, of blessed memory, who went down south to Anniston, Alabama, and to New Orleans with my grandfather in 1942-43, explained to me that she had never seen this before. What do you do when a white person sticks out his leg and trips a black man as he's walking towards the back of the bus? Do you say something? Do you not say something? And she was repulsed by it. One of her least fond memories of the war, and she would tell me many memories of the war years, was the fact that it was difficult and impossible even to do anything about anti-black bigotry in the South, that the Jew didn't want to allow for this, but what could they do? Then there was the issue of the dog tag. The dog tag for the Jew said H, had an H on it. The H stood for Hebrew. But some Jews didn't like that. The reason they didn't like that was Hebrew. Who ever heard of a Hebrew? As she writes in the book, someone says, I was never called a Hebrew in my life, nor have I ever called someone a Hebrew in my life. We're Jews. Put a J on it. So why was the H used for Hebrew? The answer is because the Reform movement had an outsized influence over American Jewish military life. And by the reform, Hebrew is a thing. Not the Hebrew language, but the notion, the identity of being a Hebrew. Hebrew Union College, Union of American Hebrew Congregations. So all the big reform institutions were Hebrew, because in the late 19th century, that was the word you used to avoid using the word Jew. Jew was a dirty word. So this struck a negative chord with many Eastern European Jews who were, you know, second generation and serving in the American military in World War II. All right, what can you do? It says H. Fine. Jews on maneuvers in the South would get off for the holidays to go to a Seder, to go to Rosh Hashanah services. And even those who were very secular and who back home would never go to shul were inclined to go to the Seder and go to the Rosh Hashanah services in whatever big southern city it was happening, whether it was in Memphis, in New Orleans, in Mobile, Atlanta, so Charleston, whatever fort you were near. They would give you a train pass, 36 hours. You can go to this big city. There's going to be a shul. There can be services. Go. And the boys went. Why? It's good to get off the base for a little while. And it's good to have Jewish camaraderie. And they needed Jewish camaraderie to survive or to make less uncomfortable the experience of soldiering in the American South. Okay. One of the questions that Jews had to deal with in the military was whether or not their fellow soldier was an anti-Semite, and Eli says in food also, there was good food. You got to eat the matzah and the charosis. So the question is, was your fellow soldier an anti-Semitic bigot, or was he just an average run-of-the-mill American Gentile who was using jocular terminology without any malicious intent? If somebody calls you a Jew boy, is that because they're looking to pick a fight and pummel you because they're an anti-Semitic SOB? Or does it just mean that, all right, you're a Jew boy and I'm a goy? So some people understood it as locker room talk, no different from calling somebody a WAP or a Dago. That you had ethnic terms, yes, they were derisive, but you didn't have to understand them as meaning a derisive intent. Okay, then, crossing over. It's time to go to war, for real. No longer training in the American South, but rather we're going to go overseas. Well, this is a very momentous occasion. Embarking on the ship, people were nervous, understandably so, but others were excited, excited that finally something real is going to happen, not just training, but the real deal. For Jews going to the Pacific, this was really like going to Mars. It was a world away, or five worlds away. But for Jews going to the Atlantic to fight against the Nazis, in the minds of some, this was not going to Europe for the first time. This was a return to Europe. Whether literally for kids who had been born overseas in the early 1920s and had immigrated to America and, you know, actually were returning because they had gained citizenship, or not even citizenship, they had just moved to America in the 1930s and were now going back to Europe. But even if your father came from Europe, or your grandfather came from Europe in 1905, and it's now 1943 or 44, and you're going on a boat to Europe, so many felt this was a return. We're going back to take care of business, that our father or our grandfather ran away from the Tsar or from this anti-Semitic country or that anti-Semitic country, and we're now coming back to take care of business. Of course, for the Gentile soldier, that attitude was non-existent. So in the Atlantic theater, there was a real difference in motivation between the Jew and the Gentile. Fewer Jews went to the Pacific. Most Jews who did go overseas went to the European theater. Why? Maybe the American military thought that there'd be greater impetus to fight in the Atlantic, and they thought it was a wise move. Or maybe this is just an accident of history. Nobody can really tell. Paul says that anyone who had an H in their tag would be, right, that they wouldn't want to be killed by the Germans. We're going to get to that, the issues of being captured. What happens if you could be captured, if you were captured? So in the Pacific theater, because there were fewer Jews, there were Jewish GIs who found fellowship in the Christian community. In other words, if there was no Jewish chaplain, if there was no Jewish camaraderie, there was nobody else around who was a religious kinsman of yours, but you wanted to have some spiritual nourishment and succor. So there were those who turned to Christianity. A small number, and outright conversions and baptisms were very few and far between, but it did happen. It did happen in the Pacific Theater. Another thing that happened in the Pacific Theater is that Jews would, in the American Army, would meet Indian Jews. And in Calcutta especially, there were rich Indian Jews. But they didn't speak Yiddish, and they were dark-skinned. So were they really Jewish? Can a person be Jewish and not speak Yiddish and have dark skin? Of course, the answer is yes. But if you never saw that before, you are incredulous at the sight of it. There was skin tone based bigotry even amongst Jews. We shouldn't forget that. So committed Zionists would seek out Jewish civilians in the places overseas where they went. Of course, not too many in the Pacific Theater, other than some Indian Jews, maybe some Australian Jews, and eventually, you know, some Jews in China, in Shanghai. But really in Europe, the American Jewish GIs would seek out local Jewish communities, first in England, and then after D-Day, or after the invasion of Italy, in Italy, and then after D-Day in France. And if you were a committed Zionist, you looked for Jewish peoplehood, camaraderie with fellow Jews on the basis of our national stock. Okay. On February 3rd, 1943, the USS Dorchester sank. It met its demise courtesy of a German U-boat that was torpedoed, and many, many hundreds died. Among those who died were the famous four chaplains, one Catholic, two Protestant, one Jew, Rabbi Alexander Goody, a Reform rabbi, a former Reform chaplain. And this Dorchester incident, in which it is claimed that the rabbis and the priests, they gave up their life jackets and whatever gloves they had, so that the other soldiers and sailors could save their lives, and that they went down with the ship, arm in arm, praying Shema Yisrael for the rabbi, other prayers for the Christians, but arm in arm, praying and singing hymns as they went down to their watery grave. It was memorialized with stamps, with poetry. In many ways, the Dorchester incident became part an icon of the American war experience, and that the faiths of democracy, the three faiths of democracy, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, are all in this together. The Judeo-Christian tradition evolved out of World War II. Already in World War I, this notion was developing, and we spent a session on American Jewish involvement in World War I. And I said that the Jewish Welfare Board was established to create a chaplaincy at that time. Yes, it was getting off the ground. But really, the Judeo-Christian civilization or tradition, this concept, which is totally a myth, there's no such thing, but it became prominent during World War II. The fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. What could be better than that? Sounds wonderful. The standard operating procedure, SOP, standard operating procedure, was something that evolved for chaplains during the war. It was created gradually. You know, each religion has its own rituals, its own beliefs. And is it really possible for a person to minister to people of another faith? Could a rabbi conduct a Christian service? Could a minister conduct a Jewish service? Could there be cooperation between clergymen of different faiths to have joint exercises of a spiritual character? These were all questions of uncertain answer. Ultimately, they would be answered in a very favorable way, but it took compromise and hard work by representatives of all the faiths to get this done. What about the private observance of Judaism by Jews during the war? So I mentioned Victor Geller, he puts tefillin on every day. At one point in the war, a Jewish superior of his told him, you can't do this anymore. You're making the Jews look bad and look funny. Stop it. It's not Brooklyn anymore. This is the war. This is Europe. You got to stop putting on tefillin. But indicative of the way the war developed from a religious point of view, the Jewish superior was overruled by a Gentile who told the Jew, you let Victor put on his prayer, say his prayers and put on his tefillin. If he wants to do it, that's his prerogative. So here you have an assimilated Jew worrying about his own status and the status of fellow Jews, thinking that being overtly Jewish and religious is going to get us all in trouble. And the goy says, no, leave the kid alone. Let him do whatever he wants. You know, freedom of worship. Interesting thing would happen during the Jewish services. There was a disproportionate number of Reform chaplains. There were 311 Jewish chaplains during World War II. 147 were Reform, 96 were conservative, and 68 were Orthodox. Why this disparity? After all, the majority of Jews in America at that time would have been either affiliated with or at least peripherally identified with the more traditional styles of worship, whether Orthodox or conservative. Reform was really like a rich man's religion for the old assimilated crowd. And yes, some of the younger Eastern European types. But why should there be so many Reform clergy and so few of the Orthodox? So the answer is that even though the military did not require a college diploma in order for someone to qualify as a chaplain, they only had to be ordained by a recognized faith group. The Jewish Welfare Board had reorganized a committee on Army, Navy, religious activities, CANRA, and they insisted that a rabbi not only be ordained properly by a seminary, but that they also have a college diploma. Well, all the HUC graduates had college diplomas. All the JTS graduates had college diplomas. But how many Orthodox rabbis in 1943-44 in America had college diplomas and were of age where they wanted to be a chaplain and serve abroad? The answer is not nearly as many. Okay, mostly the younger guys who had been recent graduates of REITs. So because of this disparity, you often had traditional Jews wanting to conduct religious services and the Jewish chaplain being a Reform rabbi who was inclined towards a less intense religious experience. And there are stories that Rabbi Ashmore writes in the book, but I also heard anecdotally from my professors over the years that you'd have a Jew coming to the davening on Shabbos or Yontif, high holidays, and he wants to daven. But they only allow the chapel to be used for Jewish services for 2 hours. Now, 2 hours is nothing for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. All right, but the chapel's being used for multiple religions in the same day. You have to, you know, be quick about things. So the rabbi wants to get up and give a speech. So here's some Reform rabbi, clean-shaven, Amerikansky, going on and on in English for a half hour about brotherhood of man and fatherhood of God and whatever other Mishigasi's talking about. But I want a Davin Shmon Esrei. So the guy gets up in the middle of the sermon and is chuckling in Davin Shmon Esrei. And the chaplain thinks it's not nice. It's disrespectful to me. I'm the chaplain. I'm a superior officer. All right, but he recognizes the guy wants to daven. So cut him some slack. Sometimes the Jews who were given the opportunity to conduct religious services did not know how to do so. And for example, Seder, the Jewish Welfare Board, and the various Jewish charities in the United States would send care packages with matzah and charosis and maror and hard-boiled egg and all sorts of yummy foods and haggadahs to the various forts around the country and even abroad after departing for overseas. And the expectation was, use this stuff and make a Seder. So the Gentile commanding officer will tell guys named Goldstein and Goldberg and Horowitz, hey, boys, this package came in from wherever. Go make a Seder for all the Jews. All right, fine. So we got to make a Seder. But what if Goldstein and Goldberg can't read Hebrew and were not really especially religious and didn't know much about a Seder? So they try their best. Or In a funny incident, they turn to a Protestant clergyman and says, "Chaplain, we're supposed to make a Seder, but we don't know how. Can you do it for us?" And the Protestant chaplain in perfect Hebrew conducts the Seder reading out of the Haggadah. All right, so funny things like this happen. Now, there's another story of a Catholic chaplain being requested to do the same thing, to run a Seder, and he refused. So why did the Protestant say yes and the Catholic say no? And what are the consequences of saying yes versus saying no? Well, the Protestant was able to reconcile it in his own mind by saying it was a reenactment of the Last Supper. The Catholic refused, saying, "This is false religion. And yes, here in the army, we're trying to be as ecumenical as possible, but we cannot be forced to violate our theological principles and religious scruples. So when we refuse, our refusal has to be accepted." And it was. So this is the army in a tough spot. It wants to have ecumenicism, but it recognizes that there are limits to ecumenicism. And if somebody says no, that, you know, no means no. Okay. Well, Jews, in order to endear themselves to their Christian fellow soldiers, and cognizant of the fact that they had been taken off at times, you know, for Jewish holidays, would volunteer to do guard duty and what other responsibilities on Easter, on Christmas. Whenever there's a Christian holiday and the Christians want to have opportunity for worship, we the Jews will take control of the fort and you guys can do whatever you need to do. So a trade-off. English language prayer was very important for the soldiers in the army, for the Jews. You know, the davening, the Hebrew davening, was intelligible to those who had an intense Jewish background, an upbringing, who went to cheder, Talmud Torah, yeshiva. They knew how to daven. But let's say you didn't know how to daven. You didn't know Hebrew. So you didn't want to be a goy. You're not a Christian. You're a proud Jew. But religious services weren't your thing, and you don't know Hebrew. So you go to religious services for the Jewish camaraderie, but while you're there, is it all gibberish? So the answer is some prayers were translated into Hebrew, into English, and the one that was especially popular was on page 320 in the Jewish Welfare Board Siddur, the Unified Jewish Siddur prayer book, and it was the prayer for home, the prayer for the United States and the prayer for home, in which you prayed that the home front was doing well and that you could go home eventually, you know, when the war was over. That was especially meaningful to a lot of the soldiers. Another thing that was especially meaningful was when the chaplain would say, "We're now going to close the prayer book and from the deep recesses of our heart, offer a silent petition to God." Because that was, you know, prayer in whatever sense you wanted it to be. You were not beholden to the official liturgy. An important aspect of military life was manliness. The question was it unmanly to pray, to show your spiritual and emotional side? And the answer is that getting all emotional in general was not considered a good thing, but prayer was not unmanly. Maybe because America was a fairly religious country, a fairly religious Protestant country, but the bottom line is, it was okay to pray. It was okay to pray. There was a question in the chat. One second. Let me just take a look. One second. The Catholic Church retired the blood libel that the Jews were guilty of the crucifixion. How did this issue resolve itself during the war? Did it cause more flare-ups? So the answer is that the Jew as Christ killer, yes, it occasionally came up. But the Catholics themselves had to worry about anti-Catholic sentiment from the Protestants. So on the whole, the Jew as Christ killer was not as big a deal in the army. It was more anti-Jewish sentiment just because Jews were seen negatively in an American context as avaricious, not serving, you know, lazy, unpatriotic, that sort of thing. Not the classic anti-Judaic tropes of the religious past. Okay. In 1944, in Italy, the question was, were Jewish chaplains ever asked to officiate at Catholic and Protestant services? And the answer is yes. And that's exactly what I was about to say. In 1944 in Italy, on Memorial Day, there was a joint memorial service. Catholics, the Protestants, and the Jews all officiated. for all the dead. And Kel Mole Rachamim by a rabbi and Psalm 23 by a chazan were chanted at this joint service. Some among the Catholics didn't like this. They thought it was a shanda that a Jew rabbi, is getting up in front of Christian dead and saying Hebrew prayers. But to the great, to the greatness of the American system, they were able to pull it off. And sometimes even for just the funeral of a private Christian soldier who died, yes, sometimes a Jewish chaplain was needed to officiate. Okay, Eli's asking about Jews in the camps. We're going to get to that very shortly. So we have 10 minutes left. Let's try to cover some of those topics. One last point about the prayer book. One of the great accomplishments of the Jewish War, Jewish Welfare Board, was the production of that siddur that was the collaborative effort of Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox rabbis. If today you were to ask the RCA, the RA, and the CCAR to join forces in making a siddur, it would never happen, okay? In the post-war era, there was the Synagogue Council of America, which was a briefly lived effort to unite all the shuls in America on the basis of the camaraderie that existed in World War II among chaplains, but it died, okay? So today we could never fathom a joint liturgical effort by multiple Jewish denominations. And yet it happened and it worked out quite nicely. And I have two copies of that prayer book. I think one will belong to my grandfather and one I found, someone made a donation to the shul and there was a whole bunch of old books. I discovered another JWB siddur with Franklin Roosevelt's, fake autograph on the front page. So, Jews under fire, heroism under fire. There was a notion that Jews were not patriotic and that Jews were fearful and not willing to expose themselves to mortal danger during the war. There was a little ditty that was making the rounds on the Instagram and Twitter of the time. And it went a little bit like this. First man to sink an enemy battleship, Colin Kelly. First man to set foot on enemy territory, Robert O'Hara. First woman to lose 5 sons, Mrs. Sullivan. First SOB to get 4 new tires, Nathan Goldstein. So this idea that Jews were profiteers, that they weren't really fighting, they were advancing materially at the expense of the war effort, it's ongoing in America and even in the army itself. And it bothered frontline Jewish soldiers. Here I am fighting to the death for the good cause. And you're saying Goldstein is a war profiteer and not fighting. Okay. Questions, what do you do with your dog tag if you're afraid of being captured? So some destroyed it or threw it away, but there was a risk involved there. Because if you didn't have one, that might have been a telltale sign that you didn't have one because you got rid of it. And why did you get rid of it? Because you were a Jew. So sometimes that didn't work as a solution to your problem. Others said, no, I won't get rid of it. I'm not going to deny my Jewishness, even if I run the risk of being put in a concentration camp by the Nazis. And also because if I get rid of it, then who's to know who I am? If I do die in war, forget being captured and sent to a concentration camp. What if I'm just blown to bits from an air raid? How do they know who I am? I won't get identified. So all these are considerations to keep the tag or lose the tag. Another question was, would you kill unarmed Nazis if you came across them? And this was a very real question that emerges after D-Day. Because as Fortress Europe falls and more territory is conquered by the Allies, so you have Jewish soldiers liberating territory and coming across surrendering German soldiers. And sometimes there's this desire for vengeance. Well, the desire for vengeance was actually not precipitated by the gas chambers and the crematoria and the final solution. Actually, it will be precipitated by a German sniper killing an American in the course of the surrender. And so here you have a dead fellow soldier on your hands. And who killed him? Well, somebody from this building here killed him. And it was a shot, the shot was fired after the surrender. So it was an illegitimate shot fired. And now you have 10 Nazis or 10 Germans in front of you and you've disarmed them. Are you gonna mow them down in a fit of rage? Jewish soldiers had to deal with this and then discuss it with their chaplain afterward in, you know, living with their decision, either not to kill or yes to kill. More often than not, much more often than not, the Jews followed military protocol and did not kill unarmed captured soldiers and not civilians. Sometimes they would find out that these, in fact, were SS officers, and then they'd feel guilty. Why didn't I kill those guys? Okay. Liberating the death camps. So this was a horrifying experience for American Jewish soldiers. They didn't know this was going to happen. Jewish soldiers in the U.S. Army did not realize that they were going to come across concentration camps because their goal was hitting military targets and rapidly advancing to conquer swaths of territory. It was only incidentally, most of the time, that they came across some concentration camp. And they'd be shocked to their core. The stench of burnt flesh they could smell from miles away would never leave them. Approaching prisoners in the striped pajamas and bone thin, they were taken aback. The liberated prisoners would kiss the hands of the soldiers, including the Jewish soldiers. Then, once that situation develops, the Jewish soldiers who speak Yiddish serve a useful role as translators. Now, they were translators already even before encountering the camps, even just in dealing with the Germans, because Yiddish is close enough to German that you could function as a translator. One of the things that they had to be careful about, though, is let's say it's not you capturing the Germans, it's the Germans capturing you, and you're a translator. Well, how do you know German? Is it because you're a Yid? So knowing too much German could be a giveaway, could be a sign, a telltale sign that this person whose name the Gentile, the German didn't know yet, but he knows a little too much, could be Zayid. Okay. Another question is, were German civilians guilty? As the war was winding down, what is your attitude towards German civilians? The rules of military conduct forbade fraternization with the enemy civilian. All right, so you weren't supposed to converse with them. You weren't supposed to have anything other than a simple hello, good morning. Okay, so Jews didn't want to fraternize with Germans, but sometimes they wanted to understand what these Germans were all about. And figuring out why it is that so many people followed the Nazis. And the curiosity led to quasi-intellectual encounters between American Jewish GIs and German civilians. Another thing that happens is holiday services in the camps in 1945. Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, this is after the war is over. And the symbolic value of having a rabbi with a talis and hundreds of Jewish soldiers with the yarmulkes on and some former concentration camp prisoners davening in a site which had been a place of death and destruction. But lastly, the question is, when are we going home? Everybody wants to go home. And for some soldiers, Jewish GIs, it was early in 45, middle of 45. Some were sent back after the war in Europe was over, on the premise that they were going to invade Japan. Of course, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki took care of that, and there'd be no invasion of Japan. Others were stuck in Europe a little while longer and didn't get home until 1946. One of my grandfathers came home in late 45. The other came home Purim Day, St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 1946. He was coming home from the Pacific. It took a little while longer. Okay. Post-war era. What happened to these people who had served? So some come home and go right back to school. You know, a kid comes home to Brooklyn, and after a celebratory meal, dad says to the son, "Son, tomorrow's the last day to register for graduate school at Columbia. So here's a train pass, go." And had they go in the GI Bill of Rights. For others, it was collecting guns for the Haganah, that their Zionism was reinforced, that the Shoah taught them we need an Israel. So collect guns for the Haganah, take my own personal effects from the war that I still had and send it off to Palestine. Another, for a really committed Zionist, make Aliyah. Or buy a house in the suburbs on the GI Bill of Rights, low rate mortgages. For others, fight for civil rights. For Jews, to fight against anti-Semitism. And for others, to fight for the rights of African Americans, whom they saw suffering in the American South. For others, It's move out of New York, move to a southern city, a western city. America is bigger than just the ethnic neighborhoods of the old eastern seaboard cities. There's a bigger world out there. Enjoy it. And also, join a shul. Even if you were not a synagogue goer in the interwar period as a kid or as a teenager, your wartime experience taught you that you need Jewish camaraderie. And how was Jewish camaraderie primarily experienced? In the context of religious activities. You didn't have to be a believer. You didn't have to be all that observant. But how did you do your Jewish things? You did your Jewish things with a chaplain, with a rabbi, under the broader auspices of Judaism, the religion. And that plays an important role in the synagogue boom of the post-war era. Okay, I'll take some questions.
Rabbi Hoffman, you didn't mention about the fall away of observance among people who grew up Orthodox.
Yes, okay, so you have that. In my family, there was one of my grandmother's brothers. They used to say he was a yeshiva boy. Now, he wasn't really a yeshiva boy, but he went to Talmud Torah in the 20s and 30s and went to Hebrew high school. And, you know, in the war, he had a tough experience. And after the war, he was on the less religious side of things than the rest of his siblings. That, you know, some people who had a very intensely Jewish upbringing with Torah study, with davening, with kosher observance, being away from that and seeing a bigger world and eating treif for 4 years took away the religious fervor. And they never recovered it. So there were plenty of people who, it wasn't even necessarily that they turned against God. It wasn't always an issue of atheism because of man's inhumanity to man. It could be that. It could be atheism and rejecting religion altogether. But it was more just, I'm not the person I once was. I'm not a kid out of Brooklyn anymore. I'm now an American soldier, an American adult, and we don't keep kosher. We don't keep Shabbos. We do other things. It happened to many, many people.
Sure. Hermann Wouk used to say that the two most important influences in his life was his Lithuanian rabbi grandfather and the U.S. Navy.
Right.
Was any soldiers, Jewish soldiers, sent to concentration camps?
Okay, so the answer to that is yes, there were some. However, the majority of Jewish soldiers who were captured were not sent to concentration camps, ended up staying with the rest of the other captured GIs, but they were treated badly where they were. Among those who were sent to concentration camps, many of them died on the transport. Sadly, the transport would last, you know, 5, 6, 7 days. There wouldn't be food, it wouldn't be water, and they didn't make it. So yes, there were several hundred American Jewish GIs, we can't know an exact number, who died because of their Jewish identity in Nazi captivity.
The Red Cross was not able to supervise the
Red Cross. The Red Cross tried, but didn't always have access to people. And unfortunately, those who did not get their care packages and were shipped off away from the rest of the American soldiers, sometimes they were never heard from again, and sometimes it was heard, but that they were dead.
I have a question, a comment. Could you elaborate a little bit about the Ritchie boys, who Jews who were served, you know, in intelligence?
So Jews who served in intelligence, this was, let's put it this way. In order to serve in intelligence, you had to be intelligent. that was number one. And so since Jews were disproportionately university educated, there was a cadre of both Ivy League and CUNY educated Jews who had great linguistic ability, were brave enough to go undercover, and were willing to work for the OSS, for the which was the predecessor of the CIA, mostly in the European theater. I don't know much about Jews doing it in the Pacific theater. There wasn't that much espionage in the Pacific theater. But in the European, yes. And the fact that the U.S. Army recognized their potential is to the credit of the U.S. Army, that they weren't, you know, going to have some sort of a ethno-religious bigotry prevent them from using the potential services of these very capable young Jews.
Well, I know Jews who came over right before the war from Germany who had a certain know-how about, you know, right. and they were inducted into this.
It was very dangerous, because being dropped into continental Europe all alone, whether by parachute or however, or sneaking in through Turkey, there were ways to get individual operatives into continental Europe, but it was extremely dangerous. Plenty didn't survive the war, and to the extent that they were able to gather intelligence, you know, kudos to them, and it did help the war effort.
There was a case of a Harvard professor in Asian studies who came to Asian studies because he tested into Japanese language skills and intelligence when they broke the Japanese code.
Yeah.
So there were a number of people who went on to develop PhDs in their linguistic fields and became professors.
Interesting. Okay, there's a question in the chat about Dov Zlotnik. So there were those who stayed after the war to help survivors. This was an important point I left out. Let me just close with this.
Right.
It was a real question whether or not American Jewish soldiers should be involved in civilian and affairs after the war for fellow Jews. After all, that's not what I was sent here to do. I'm an American soldier. I'm supposed to do what my orders are, and when I go home, when they tell me to go home. However, if you really, in your kishkas, wanted to help the plight of survivor Jews, well, then you did it, even if your orders were otherwise. And getting food to the survivors, leading spiritual, you know, religious services for the survivors, this was an important thing. And Rabbi Zlotnik and others played an important, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, father of J.J. Schachter. There are several very famous American rabbis who hung around Europe longer than the war, after the war was over, to do, you know, God's work, not just for American soldiers, but for the survivors of the Shoah, and that was their main focus. And one of the things they did was use the offices of the American military, and for that matter, the Red Cross, to find family members of survivors, that you should match lists to see, is my relative still alive? Well, how do you do that? The American military helped facilitate that, but not that the American military really cared, but Jewish chaplains and Jewish soldiers did the angelic work in making that possible. Okay, we'll stop here. Next time, our discussion will be about American Jewry recovering from the war, the immediate post-war era of 45 to roughly 1950, what the domestic life was like for American Jews. Okay, everybody, have a good night.
Thank you. Shavuot Tov.